From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Unicorns live, for now anyway, tech unicorns. Their number of private companies valued at more than $1 billion went from 40 2 years ago to 145 today. That is a huge jump. Many of them you've likely heard of: Uber, Airbnb, Pinterest, Spotify. Those four companies together are now valued at close to $100 billion. But there are so many more at sky-high valuations before they ever go public. Many investors fear there's a unicorn bubble. This hour, On Point Unicorns, a tech investment bubble, and whether it's about to burst. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is this your world? Do you see a bubble about to pop, or blue skies, big opportunity? And if unicorns do go off a cliff, what does that mean for the rest of the economy? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Everybody's talking about it lately. New York Times columnist Nick Bolton talked to CNBC in October about unicorns and a potential tech bubble.
The valuations of companies are just completely out of whack, and no one has any idea where these numbers are coming from. You've got Uber that's at $50 billion. You've got companies like Slack that are at $2.8 billion. You know, a lot of these numbers are kind of coming out of thin air. And I think there's actually a fourth thing, which is that if you look at some of the companies that have gone public over the last couple of years, a lot of them, their stocks are down. Twitter, Groupon, Yelp. And I think all of these things are kind of pointing to something that we've seen before, which was the bubble burst in 1999.
Nick Bolton there, the economist, writing in the last few days, the past few years have seen money slosh toward anyone in a hoodie. But venture capitalist Marc Andreessen, the big champion of what's going on out there, says there's a lot of potential in that big basket of unicorns. If just a few of them pay out, they could pay out enormously here. Here's Andreessen talking with Fortune magazine editor Alan Murray early last month about unicorns.
The nature of venture capital and the nature of venture investments is some companies are going to work and some companies aren't. And so among the unicorns, the companies that work are going to end up being, are going to end up looking.
But as a basket.
Dramatically. Oh, as a basket.
As a basket, it's too low.
As a basket, it's almost certainly too low. Well, as a basket, the entire basket of unicorns is worth like half of Microsoft. Like the entire basket right. of all the unicorns is
so
worth like half
of
Microsoft.
Them,
Microsoft
if one of them becomes Microsoft.
Microsoft's a fine company, but like, you need a couple to really take off. And it becomes very clear in
so
retrospect
you,
that they run the value.
A basket of unicorns, try and get your head around that image, but it is overall undervalued. There from Marc Andreessen. Joining me now from San Francisco is Alexandra Suich, U.S. technology editor for The Economist magazine, where they've been doing some great reporting on this. You can link to her recent report on unicorns at our website, onpointradio.org. Alexandra, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What is driving this? I've got a list here in my hand of all these companies now valued at a billion or more. These are startups. They're not very old. Some of them meant much more than a billion. I mean, Uber's 51, Xiaomi 46 billion, Airbnb 25 billion, Snapchat 16 billion, and right on down. What has driven this? They're not out in the public market. This is private investment money gushing in at these very, very large valuations. Why, Alexandra?
A few reasons. The interest rates are so low right now that investors are struggling to find yield elsewhere. A lot of people think, who are able to invest in these private companies, that these are lottery ticket investments. A lot of them won't turn out, but if they get one big winner, if they invest early in what's the next Facebook or what's the next Google, that's going to pay off massively. So they're willing to take risks, and as Marc Andreessen, the venture capitalist, said, willing to take the losses probably on the majority of their investments if they have a few big winners. As you mentioned, companies are staying private longer and not issuing shares to the public. So the only way to be able to invest in unicorns or other private technology companies is to go into them while they're still private. That's what's helping push up these valuations. And entrepreneurs are wanting to reach these billion-dollar or more valuations and be part of the unicorn club. So are accepting some rigorous terms from investors in order to get to be worth, quote unquote, $1 billion or more.
There's a lot we want to look at here, but if I'm not a venture capitalist, a VC, if I'm not, you know, shoveling tens or hundreds of billions of dollars in here, why do I care? What does this matter to an ordinary person?
These are some of the most exciting companies that we've seen in a long time, things with major implications for consumers' lives. You mentioned Uber, which is a taxi hailing firm, which is trying to reconceive of how people transport themselves by car daily. Snapchat, how people communicate via messaging. A lot of really interesting companies. So the innovations that are happening in the private markets affect public lives. The bigger question is one you alluded to, which is this going to be a repeat of the last dot-com bubble? And is this going to start tumbling down? We saw trillions of dollars in people's net worth destroyed the last time around. So I think there's a lot of concern that that history will repeat itself and this will end as messily as it did before. Our opinion at The Economist is that it will not.
And you think it'll go on, but if it doesn't, if it would blow up, it wouldn't just be a bunch of Teslas for sale in Silicon Valley, but could ripple out across the country, across the whole economy.
Well, I think that the implications of a bursting of this bubble is much more limited because these are private investors who are taking the risk. A lot of them are managing public money, so there's some pension funds and endowments that are and mutual funds that are investing money on the public's behalf. But the amount of money that's at risk is much less than last time. I also think that a contagion isn't as likely. So because these are private companies, if there's a correction or if they fail, it's unlikely to take down other companies simply because of panic this time around, like we saw in the last tech bust.
Mark Andreessen says there's a lot of value here. Bill Gurley at Benchmark Capital says, well, you know, it may be as bad as 99. It might not be. He says, arguing we aren't in a bubble because it's not as bad as 1999, he tweeted, is like saying that Kim Jong-un is fine because he's not as bad as Hitler. Alexandra, is there a vision implicit in these super high valuations here of the future? So, you know, some new version of the sort of internet revolution vision of the 90s? Is there some unifying vision that would describe the economy, society is going to be different, and these companies are going to lead the way, and that justifies this.
I think that everyone is interested in getting access to the next big investment. And there's an acronym that's floated around in Silicon Valley and San Francisco called FOMO. It's fear of missing out. And so there's a psychological part of this equation where no one wants to miss out on the next big thing. The thing that I think a lot of people didn't realize is that the big companies from the last wave, so the Googles of the world, Facebooks, even Apples, which are much more mature, have continued to dominate the tech landscape. So people thought that there would be room for mini food delivery services, mini car sharing apps, all of these quote-unquote revolutionary offerings. And what we've found is that the large incumbent firms have been incredibly adept at transforming themselves to continue to have a large market share. So an example of that would be cloud computing, which allows for people to store their documents and access their documents remotely. It's very important in the business space. And people thought that Dropbox, which is now valued at $10 billion, mm-hmm. would be able to dominate that market. We've seen Google and Amazon be very smart about positioning themselves to have relevance there. And they're the large players. So I think that people did not anticipate that the next wave of firms might actually be outdone by their predecessors.
Are these values for real, or is this all smoke and mirrors? I'm reading here from Vanity Fair. They're talking with a venture capitalist, and he asked a CEO why he had valued his young company at $1 billion. And it was told, quoting here, we need to be worth $1 billion to be able to recruit new engineers. So we decided that was our valuation. That just sounds like made up.
There is a bit of fiction to the unicorn land, I think, at this point. Investors are willing to accept these very high valuations so long as they get to set the other terms. And so they want to be protected because they understand these are very lofty valuations, basically formed on a dream that the company may one day be able to achieve these high benchmarks. And so they have written in certain protections, like the idea that they'll get their money back first, or if a company goes public at a lower valuation than the last round of financing, they'll be issued more shares. So
a lot of those engineers then and employees could be hurt here because that would cram them down. That would leave them with not so much.
You're exactly right. I think the people who are going to be most hurt, who are part of the valley, are the employees who see these valuations as more real. But their stock options are going to be diluted, potentially, if the company doesn't live up to these valuations. And most of them will not, I think.
Who's pouring all this money in here? Is it all venture capital, or is it wider than that now? You mentioned pension funds.
Exactly. It's gone. It has gone wider. So venture capitalists are typically the ones who invest in the very early stages of a firm's life. As companies are staying private longer and longer, we're seeing more firms come in at the later stage private round. So we've seen mutual funds come in, which manage money for the public and would typically be investing during an initial public offering when these firms go public, but want to get in earlier now. And we're seeing other venture, quote unquote, tourists. So we're seeing some sovereign wealth funds come forward. We're seeing Saudi princes, Russian oligarchs, hedge funds, firms that don't necessarily have the expertise in tech who are bidding up the value of these investments at later stages.
Some of those mutual funds already cutting the value, writing down the value of these. Fidelity, you report, writing down Dropbox by 20%, Snapchat by 25%, Zenefits, never heard of it, but never mind, MongoDB by 50% each. Does that mean that the bubble's already coming undone?
Some of it is a reflection of these private companies not reaching their growth targets, and some of it is about the public market. So in the last quarter, we've seen a lot of volatility in the public market, and valuation experts at those firms are required to match what they think the value of those private firms are to their public benchmark. So in some cases, it's not just a reflection of those firms, but their public peers.
Is this all because the Fed held down interest rates? Is that the bigger story here?
It's a huge part of it. Yield is hard to come by elsewhere, so tech is looking all the more attractive.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about fears of a tech bubble and the wild proliferation of so-called unicorns, tech startups valued at more than $1 billion before they ever hit the public stock market. Uber and Airbnb and many, many more now, 140-plus unicorns running around. It was 40 or fewer just a couple of years ago. Here's one of those, Snapchat. What is it now, $16 billion or something? Its valuation, a little ad from Snapchat.
Snapchat stories celebrate the power of different perspectives. Sometimes, a particular point of view grabs your attention. You just have to experience more. Today, you will. Simply swipe up on a snap to explore a moment from every angle.
$16 billion and 140-plus more at values of more than $1 billion before they ever hit the public market. You can join us this hour. What do you see here? Has a flood of cash out there pushed these valuations to unsustainable, undeserved heights? Are the unicorns headed for a cliff? Is tech living in a unicorn-led bubble? And if tech comes crashing down, what about the rest of the market, the rest of the economy? Alexandra Sewich has written it all up for The Economist in their recent edition. You can link to her coverage at our website, onpointradio.org. A couple more big voices joining us now from Stanford, California. Josh Rao is with us, professor of finance at Stanford's Graduate School of Business. Josh Rao, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
And from Austin, Texas, Bob Metcalf joins us, kind of a legend in this realm, professor of innovation at the University of Texas at Austin's Cockrell School of Engineering, inventor of the Ethernet, the local area networking standard, founder of 3Com, merged with Hewlett-Packard back in 2010, partner emeritus at VC firm Polaris Venture Partners, also visiting innovation fellow at MIT this year. Bob Metcalf, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, thanks.
We want to get your view on this, Bob. But Josh, let me come to you first. There's a lot of hand-wringing out there right now that this is all poised to come apart at the seams, that there's a big bubble, unicorns running around in it, and it can't last. What do you say?
Well, I teach a class at Stanford GSB called Launch to Liquidity, and we study these companies in real time, including unicorns. And over the several years that I've taught the course, something really interesting has happened. At the start, the most ambitious companies were aiming for an IPO. They wanted to be listed on the stock exchange. Venture capital was just a means to generate escape velocity and get them to the dream of an IPO. But now, the most successful companies, in some cases the same companies that were dreaming of the IPO a couple of years ago, they don't want to go public anymore. They're telling us, hey, we can get better valuations in the private market than in the public market. Venture capitalists will give us more financial support than the public markets, and these VCs are giving us valuations of $1, $10, $50 billion. So we're just going to stay private for the foreseeable future. And that leads to the question, I think, you know, who is right? Are the firms really worth the valuations implied by the VC deals? Are they worth the still high but not peak valuations that are being obtained by stocks that are being listed on the NASDAQ and undergoing IPOs like Box.com and Square and Match? Or maybe are all the markets a bit haywire and putting really high valuations on companies as the Fed has driven interest rates to zero and has kind of seduced investors who can't stand the idea of 0% returns to take on risk in all sorts of ways?
So is the bubble already going if those private investors are marking down some of those investments, Dropbox, Snapchat, Zenefits, more?
Well, I wouldn't say the bubble is already going. I think it's – you have to think about where, first of all, these valuations have come from. And this was pointed out in the previous segment as well that, you know, these are implied valuations from recent funding rounds, and they're not really true valuations. There's a big difference between paying, say, you know, $100 million for 10% of a company with no strings attached, which would seem to imply a $1 billion valuation, versus doing that same thing but attaching all kinds of stipulations that, you know, you have the right to force the founders to sell if they don't want to, or to get extra payments if the proceeds don't cover the initial investment and things like that. So the public and private valuations are not totally comparable. I think you also have to think about where the VCs are getting their money from. You know, these venture capitalists are not investing their own money. They're getting it from wealthy institutional investors and also pension funds. And a lot of these have explicit return targets or spending targets. They just can't live with the idea of 0 or 1% returns on safe securities. So they're in venture capital. They're taking a lot of risk. And they seem to be willing to put up with weak returns in the short term if they still believe in the long term. The problem is how long the belief in that long term is going
to
last.
Josh, I want to go to Bob Metcalf, but quickly, why does this matter to people beyond the golden realm of venture capitalists?
Well, first of all, it matters through the fact that even though a lot of people aren't aware of this, you know, your city and state pension funds, which are investing in order to provide pension benefits to public employees, they are investing billions and billions of dollars in alternative asset classes, including venture capital. And they're doing that in order to try to target very high returns. Cities and states around the country are assuming that every dollar they invest in order to pay public employee pensions when these public employees retire is going to this money is going to double every 9 or 10 years. And in order to support that, they're investing in risky asset classes, and they've moved a lot more towards these riskier asset classes. If those asset classes, including venture, turn out not to be what everyone has hoped that they will be, then what you're going to see is more higher taxes at the local level, less services at the local level, because this pension money is debt that these governments have got to pay.
There, the rubber could meet the road for a lot of people. Josh Rao, please stand by at Stanford. Alexandra Sewage with The Economist out of San Francisco. Bob Metcalf, let me come to you. You've been in this world for a long time. You've seen cycles up and down. You've seen bubbles come and go. What do you make of where we stand right now, Bob?
Well, the smart money is divided. You know, you have Gurley saying we're headed to a bust. You have Andreessen saying we're already in the bust and everything's going to be great. I think they're both right. I think the down round has begun. The unicorn down round has already started. And we talked briefly about contagion earlier. I don't think the contagion will go from the unicorn markets. It'll come to the unicorn from the free money. You know, we have a free money bubble that I think is going to burst, a huge bubble, and that'll take the unicorns down.
You're talking Fed policy and how easy the money has flowed since the effort to get out of the recession. You think that's where the grenades are, the danger lies?
Yeah, Alexandra referred to it earlier. The investable capital is looking for yield, and it's not finding it because interest rates are zero, so it's venturing out into the venture capital markets where the unicorns are benefiting with inflated valuations.
It's hard to do, but let's park the money aside for just a moment, Bob, and think about the value of these innovations themselves. I mean, this should be premised on what new efficiency and benefits coming to the economy, coming to society. When you look at this 140-plus long list of companies valued at over $1 billion, Do you see a revolutionary wave of innovation here that would improve life and bolster the economy in doing it?
Yes, I agree with John Doerr, who makes the argument that the here's the internet, 3.2 billion people now connected, and it's growing. And there's a bunch of industries that are ripe for innovation, or let's call it disruption, energy, education, healthcare. So I think that's what's underneath all of this is the promise of the internet, which is far from over. We're benefiting increasingly from the network effects of having 3.2 billion people on the internet and more coming.
So your real complaint here is with bigger economic policy, not with VC investment patterns. You're saying it's the Fed and all the money that's flowed, that you're seeing putting things in danger.
Well, if you're starting companies, there can be too much money available, and I think that's what's happened. The free money regime we've been under is created too much money, and for entrepreneurs, that creates problems because it creates too many competitors in each field, and they damage each other.
We've got a lot of callers for the three of you. Bob Metcalf, Josh Rao, Alexandra Sewich, please stand by. Elizabeth is calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Elizabeth, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am the founder of a consumer product company in Boston, and the concern about these VC investment patterns that I don't hear being discussed is that the sort of VC obsession with these tech companies and with unicorns, where they're looking for huge returns and huge exits and all of that, is that I heard the speaker from The Economist say that she didn't think that it would have the same ripple effect throughout the entire economy. I disagree, because part of the problem with these tech companies is that often a lot of their revenue is from advertising rather than from users who are actually paying for the service. People don't pay to use Facebook or Twitter.
Yep.
It's an advertising revenue. And that advertising revenue comes predominantly from consumer product companies. And consumer product companies actually make up 70% of the U.S. GDP and U.S. spending. And so there's a real problem, actually, if those companies implode, and if the VCs find that the tech bubble, the unicorn bubble, is to burst, that it will not only affect the people who are investing in those and the pension funds, which you've already mentioned, but also the consumer product companies themselves. And I can say from experience, my company is a hybrid consumer product and digital content. We have an app, so we have a tech piece. However, investors are so hesitant to have anything to do with consumer product companies, which has huge impacts for the U.S. economy in terms of U.S. manufacturing, U.S. jobs. And as I said, these companies are actually providing the advertising revenue that these unicorns are actually.
Yeah, Elizabeth, I think we've got it. I mean, you're making the argument that in a way that you're real and the internet is not, and it's a kind of dreamland, and the real economy is where there's something material, and this is smothering that, all the money going here, or worse, if it goes bust. Josh Rao, what about the argument from your perspective in Stanford?
Well, I think there is a very good point here that these unicorns, these new technology firms, they are actually nothing without the rest of the economy. And so, indeed, consumer products and other areas of the economy, I mean, this is where revenues for these companies are going to come from. I think even the best and most well-known unicorns face a huge challenge, which is that in order to justify these valuations, they need cash flow. They need cash flow. And, you look at a company like Pinterest, which has maybe $100 million in annual revenues compared to a valuation of $11 billion. And you just ask, where is that valuation coming from? Some of it is that $11 billion is to some extent a bit fudged or fictitious because there are all these venture capital terms. But there's no question that investors are willing to pay a lot of money for a slice of Pinterest. And it must be because they believe, either they're just taking a hope and a prayer that Pinterest will be the next Facebook, that they'll find a way. But, really they're thinking about, okay, Pinterest may find ways to actually generate cash flow by drawing on these other sectors of the economy, either through advertising or selling services or big data or other exciting things. And that's a really uncertain proposition.
Alexandra Sewich, what about the argument that this is in some dimension a kind of a parasite on some deeper, more material economy? It takes resources now and could make more vanish if things go belly up.
What I took from the caller's question was how dollars are being passed around. So the caller is right that a lot of the revenue streams for some of these unicorns are advertising based, and some of the bigger tech firms, too, Google and Facebook. If we see some sort of collapse, will this drag down some of these large unicorns or other companies when it comes to their advertising revenues? I do think there's this interesting phenomenon going on behind the scenes where venture capital-backed companies are helping support other venture capital-backed companies. So if we see a culling of some of the unicorns, that might drag down others because they've been propping each other up. They're each other's biggest customers. Again, don't buy the fact that this is going to have huge contagious effects on the market.
Bob Metcalf, you've been around to see other bubbles. To the extent that that's what we've got here, how does it compare in scale? And if it stumbles, what about the pain that would come?
It depends which bubble. I've tried to argue there's two bubbles. There's the unicorn bubble, and then there's the debt bubble. The debt bubble is going to be huge compared to previous bubbles.
You mean like federal debt, national debt.
Student debt. I mean, debt everywhere.
All debt, okay.
All debt with zero interest rate, and something that can't last.
Unicorns grazing on all that sort of free pasture there, but it's bigger than the tech bubble, you're saying. It could hit innovation from that angle as well.
Yeah, well, you could also complain, as I think the caller was, that the VCs are investing too much in social mobile cloud. That is, the unicorn bubble is too focused on social mobile cloud, and one of the correct aspects of the correction will be a diversification out of social mobile cloud into energy, health, education, et cetera.
If that could happen or should happen, why isn't it? There's so much money out there, you say, and there's clearly need for better energy alternatives.
I guess it's been that those other areas of investment haven't shown rapid returns, large rapid returns, the kinds that have been experienced by, say, Google and Facebook.
Josh Rao, are we seeing evidence of our economy working in a rational way here, sort of optimizing by going into all this social mobile cloud investments, Snapchat and all the rest, or misallocation?
Well, I think you've got to look at the big picture. I mean, the implied paper valuation of unicorns is, I guess you could say, around $500 billion. Sounds like a lot, but as we said, in many ways, that's not real money. That's not actual money that any individual person has received. The total value of the U.S. public stock market is $20 trillion, and globally it's more like $70 trillion. And then there's over $100 trillion in publicly traded debt securities, which is what we've been hearing about. So I think it doesn't seem that the economy has tilted over to being totally app-based economy. I will say that clearly, where the financing of innovation is concerned, there are some questions about whether the resources that are being devoted to innovation are going towards the things that are going to have the most societal impact. I mean, if you want to put a really stark line on it, you could ask, is enough money being dedicated to cure cancer compared to developing apps?
Do you see, Alexandra Sewich, in your reporting, are people heading for the exits here, apart from the mutual funds marking some of these down, or just hanging in because this is where the bright lights are?
We are just starting to see the beginning signs of a gentle correction, I would call it. And I think I think many people hope that this is the start of rationality coming into the tech market. We will have to wait to see if it fully takes hold. But I agree with something that Bob mentioned earlier, that this will, in fact, be very helpful to some of the unicorns and other tech firms that are being crowded out by Me Too competitors. It's very hard to see who is real and what the real innovations are versus copycats. And so if funding becomes harder to come by, I think the strong will survive and the weak will go away, which will be better for the strong.
On Point is sponsored by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses made in America. They're engineered for comfort and long-lasting support with just the right sink, just the right bounce. Two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together for better nights and brighter days. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. Here's the great part. You can try one risk-free for 100 days with free delivery and returns. Go to casper.com/onpoint. That's casper.com/onpoint. And remember to use promo code ONPOINT at checkout to receive a special offer. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about fears of a tech bubble and the wild proliferation of so-called unicorns, tech startups valued at more than $1 billion before they ever hit the public stock market. Head of the pack in that number, Uber, now valued at over $50 billion. Here's a recent ad.
When Uber comes to a city, it's multiplicative on transportation services in that city.
When we started a few years ago, it was just a couple of us in a room. Now we're in over 60 countries and hundreds of cities and counting. The goal is to have Uber in every city, everywhere in the world.
Okay, maybe we will and maybe we won't. Bob Metcalf is with us, professor of innovation, the University of Texas at Austin. Alexandra Sewich with The Economist out of San Francisco here today. Josh Rao, professor of finance at Stanford's Graduate School of Business. You can join us. Listeners far from unicorn land, what do you make of all this? The money, the prospects, the risk of a bubble and a burst. A lot of response online here. Hanno says, FOMO, fear of missing out, is the most necessary part of the greater fool theory. A little skepticism there. Ian says, the tech bubble is attached to the hip, at the hip to the real estate bubble, and the Bay Area is currently experiencing when tech pops. Watch what happens to real estate. Ay, ay, ay. Omaha guy says, this sounds suspicious. Are these valuations a form of money laundering, tax laundering, a scam against naive, wealthy foreigners? Alexandra Sewich, is that what it means when Saudi princes come in?
It's certainly worth being cautious about. I think this quote-unquote smart money, the venture capitalists, think that valuations have gone so high that it's probably worth questioning whether the new investors are being wise or foolish in following them.
Let's go to Dove in Nashville, Tennessee. Dove, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Two comments. I've been working in venture financing as well as early stage and startup businesses in healthcare for about 6 years now.
Okay.
Just two comments that I think are worth adding some texture. One has to do with risk and one has to do with growth. So risk. Different communities regionally around the country and around the world have different appetites for risk. So the venture financing community in the Bay Area and Silicon Valley have simply a greater appetite in general. This is generalities for risk, and they behave as such, and they tend to take more moonshots. Here in Nashville, in Tennessee, we have a much different appetite for risk, and so investments and the businesses that get invested in tend to look and function differently. That's just one comment.
Okay.
The other comment has to do with growth, and that is you can look at unicorns, you can also look at dinosaurs, and you can look at what are now being termed as cockroaches.
Who's a dinosaur? Who's a cockroach?
Very large, antiquated, or I should say very large, complex, matrixed organizations that tend to trade on public exchanges. Okay, they have a harder time innovating, right? Their rate of innovation generally tends to be slower, arguably so. And so their growth rate tends to look different than unicorns. Then you look at an organization that some people are now terming as cockroaches, and they tend to be focused on more sustainable models of growth. That is, they are able to bring products and services to market earlier and generate revenue. A lot of unicorns are either pre-revenue or the revenue that they're generating is so far off balance from what their valuation is that that may be adding to what you're terming as a bubble.
So maybe smaller and durable for the cockroaches. Does it make sense what you see as a guy in this realm? Do you see a bubble, Dove, watching from Nashville?
I think that there are bubbles, but I think that it all depends on what your appetite for risk is. And I think that, like any smart investor, if you diversify, then I think that you're hedging your risk. I just think that when you look at the industries that are quote-unquote ripe for disruption, healthcare being one of them, education being another,
mm-hmm.
you have to look at these as institutions that have very large sums of money and human capital invested in them. Another part of this equation has to do with human capital. Who are we investing in? Who's the talent? Where's that talent coming from? And can that talent deliver on the promise of their value proposition?
Jeff, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Bob Metcalf, we heard Mark Andreessen earlier say, if this is a basket full of unicorns here, all it takes is one or two, Google's or Microsoft's, to come out of this, and you're in the black, and maybe way, way in the black. When you look at this list of 140-plus companies with this kind of valuation, do you see Google's and Amazon's and Microsoft's and Facebook's in there, Bob?
I do, and I think probably a lot of them are owned by Mark Andreessen, who tends to be right about these things. So what I think we can hope for, what was mentioned earlier, is that we're now in the midst of a slow, rational down round of things to get valuations properly aligned, rather than we're about to confront a huge bust.
So how do you account for the gap then between Bill Gurley's analysis and Andreessen's? They're both smart guys with a lot of experience here.
I think they're both right. I think it's hard to account for differences between these two geniuses. They're both right. The bust is occurring, and the fundamental value of the winners in that basket is huge.
Josh, how do you look at these two different views of what's going on and rationalize it?
Well, I think the way it's been described so far is about accurate. You know, there is not a pop happening right now, but maybe a slow return to something that is a little bit more rational in terms of not just ever increasing valuations. And I do think, you know, if you look at the 1999 tech boom and the ensuing bust, you know, it certainly did produce some long-term winners. I mean, yeah, you had Pets.com, which was a ridiculous idea, and you had a number of interesting ideas back then that actually were just too early, such as Benz and Flues, which were online currencies, a little bit too early. Bitcoin came along later. There were grocery delivery companies that were laughed at and went bankrupt. So some ideas just were too early. But out of that, you have, you know, Amazon came out of that, which is, you know, you gotta spend money to make money. They haven't turned a profit for long, but they're the biggest retailer. If you'd invested in Amazon, you know, you would have had, you know, six times more what you had at the peak of the internet boom in 1999. eBay is another one. Of course, Google a little later. Salesforce worth $50 billion today. And so, you know, from that experience, even though there were a lot of companies that went bust, there were long-term winners. And it is true that in such a portfolio, you only need a few before that looks like a reasonable overall portfolio.
Anthony in Charlotte, North Carolina. Anthony, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is Anthony. And I want to say that there is going to be a correction. And the people that are going to get hurt are the people who cannot cash out right now. There's going to be a correction because there's so much money sitting out there. And when the Federal Reserve raises interest rate, there will be a correction. And the people who cannot get out will be the people that get hurt.
So
a lot of people, a lot of pension funds, a lot of endowments, a lot of sovereign wealth funds will get hurt.
So watch out. You see it coming. Anthony, I appreciate your call. There's the fear factor. Larry in Acton, Massachusetts. Larry, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I would love to hear your guest answer the question that you asked earlier, and that is, what real social value exists in that list of 140 unicorns? How many are really in energy, health, education that would really be of value to our society? If the bubble burst on a Snapchat or a Pinterest, would it really matter? What are we really losing if we lose those companies? And how many of those unicorns really are serving the world?
Larry, I appreciate your call. Bob Metcalf, take us down to real basics there. I mean, you hear the tenor and the thrust of that question.
Yeah, I think the point was made earlier, we have different appetites for risk, but we also have different taste in what value is. And I constantly complain that we should be investing more in energy, education, healthcare, et cetera, instead of social mobile cloud.
Why don't we? Are we caught up in bubbles somehow here? Not bubbles, but baubles?
Shiny yeah. New things.
Yeah.
Well, I think the thing underneath it all is the internet is still an amazing value generator, including in areas that we would consider socially valuable. And I think that's what's driving it all. And then this excess money has poured in, so we have all this fluff around it.
Is there something wrong with our allocation system, Josh, if we're having billions that are going to fluff? Value, but also fluff?
Well, it certainly is true that the market in the short term does not always direct funds towards things that might be in the very, very long term beneficial. And you know, if you look at the list of unicorns, I mean, there are certainly healthcare companies on this. There are education companies on this. It's not lost that those are big markets as well. But it is, you know, this is a market driven phenomenon. And it may not be the distribution of industries here may not be what you would wish if you were just thinking about overall social welfare. I would agree with that.
Alexander, what about when Janet Yellen finally comes along with a little tiny uptick in interest rates? Is that an important signal here? Will we still be in more or less free money days, the kind that Bob Metcalf describes?
I think the way that interest rates are going to go, well, it'll be a while yet before we see money leave the tech sphere. Rates will still be too low to get real returns elsewhere.
So that means the bubble goes on.
I think it, again, kind of a gentle correction, not a run for the exits like Anthony, the caller, suggested.
Sharon, Massachusetts. Irfan, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to make a comment on a small study as an individual investor I have been conducting on my own with my own money. And if you look at the Twitter, it was worth $50 a year ago. And if you look at GoPro, it was worth $60 a year ago. Now, GoPro is worth $20, and a Twitter is worth around about $25, which means that these baby horses are being ready for long-term race. And that's how I see it as a 33 years old. And if I want to invest in my kids' future, if I invest now, I'm hoping in 10, 20 years these companies would survive and pay the return off.
So are you ready to get in now, or are you waiting for this correction, this bleed, or this bust?
I think I'm ready to get in now for the more real prices, which is these companies are making real products, and it's too big to fail in a current market.
So do you want them to go public so you can get a piece of them? If you're not a VC, yeah. It's not easy to get in there.
Absolutely, and I think like as a small guy and then in the main street talk, if you want to conduct on the ground beside these bubble talks, I think the individual investors have to look at the tried and tested products like Twitter, like GoPro, like Facebook. These companies have gone public, and they have gone through up and down, and they have turned from unicorn to baby horses who are getting ready for the big race in the long term.
Irfan, we've got it. One more right here. Robert in Bethel, Vermont. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was just curious with your guests on how they feel about pension funds and mutual funds back in 2008 when they lost their shirts. How could they be risking reinvesting monies towards and into the unicorn companies and putting the pension receivers at a huge risk? That was my question. I'm curious to hear the responses.
Let's go to our finance professor. Josh, what about it?
Well, really what's underappreciated is that they're putting taxpayers at huge risk because those pensions have got to be paid no matter what. These are public employee pensions. And how can it be, and that's a great question, how can it be they lost so much money, how can it be that now they're taking on even more risk than ever? It all goes back to that, you know, 0% essentially that they can get in safe securities. For pension funds around the U.S., for them, for their budgeting, they need to try to somehow, with some hope, justify their return assumptions, the assumption that they're going to earn actually 7.75% is a typical return assumption. And one way to do that has been to invest in asset classes such as venture capital, private equity, real estate, hedge funds, that are not that liquid and also not that transparent. So you can say, hey, there really is a hope that we might earn, you know, 10% per year on these. It's not a very realistic hope, and it's also a dangerous game to be playing. Will they achieve these returns with these investments? It seems quite unlikely.
In a roundabout way, another bailout in the making there, kind of at once removed. But we've got a listener here, Darren, says, waiting for the Silicon Valley crash and when the U.S. bails them out to save America. I mean, you're suggesting if the government has to come in to make up those pension monies, that is a kind of bailout in a backhanded way.
Well, that's right. I mean, the question is who is going to come in to support that. I think, you know, there will be some places that will be able to raise taxes and cut spending enough to be able to make not just payments to pensioners, but also just debt payments that state and local governments owe, and also the federal government. And I think that as Bob Metcalf was speaking of, I mean, there is a debt bubble in the U.S., and the federal government has massive amounts of debt. $18 trillion is the official number, but if you add in a lot of other promises that they've made regarding health healthcare and other things, it's been estimated to be as large as $100 trillion. And so, you know, where is that going to come from? Either these promises are going to be defaulted on, or there's going to have to be some kind of bailout, probably through the Federal Reserve.
Bob Metcalf, step back, step up to that level where you've expressed a lot of concern about the big picture of national debt. What do you see coming? And if all that does come down, what happens to the American economy, innovation? Will it just look like a la-la land we've been living in here?
Well, I'm not an expert on fiscal policy, but I am an expert on innovation. And I see bubbles as a tool of innovation. And the coming bust, let's hope it's not a crash. Let's hope it's a gradual down round. But the coming crash is a helpful adjustment that maybe will move us on to other fields of investment out of social mobile cloud.
But when you take it all the way to the national debt level, does it still look like that kind of incremental move that we're toying with here?
Well, who knows what happens when interest rates start going up? I'm not an expert on that. Let's go back to Josh on that one.
Let me stick with you for 1 second on this, taking all this into the private realm and out of being publicly traded companies. Is that a healthy thing for this sector?
I think people are reluctant to go public for a bunch of reasons. One, you've already touched on, which is the valuations seem to be better in late stage private. But then there's increasing regulation of public companies, increasing litigation of public companies when they don't perform. And then there's that quarterly biology that they all have to live to, all of which are unattractive and are reasons to stay private.
And so puts us in this new age where people are happy to be unicorns in this green pasture. We'll see how green for how long. Bob Metcalf at the University of Texas at Austin at the Cockrell School of Engineering there. Thank you very much for joining us today, Bob.
Thank you very much.
Josh Rao, Professor of Finance at Stanford's Graduate School of Business. Thank you, Professor Rao.
Thanks for inviting me.
And Alexandra Sewich at The Economist out of San Francisco. You got us going. Thanks for being here today, Alexandra.
Thank you so much. It was fun.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.